Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I'm now in 2 Samuel chapter 2. We're going to do the entire chapter today, verses 1 through 32. We'll entitle this chapter, David Becomes King and the Battle of Gibeon. Our context is this. In the last chapter, 2 Samuel 1, David has heard of Saul's death at Gilboa. He's just returned from mashing up on the Amalekites who destroyed his city, Ziklag, and he's returned to Ziklag, probably getting ready to rebuild it. He finds out about Saul dying. He composes this nice song, the Song of the Bow, and that's where we are now in 2 Samuel 2, verse 1. Then it came about afterwards that David inquired of the Lord, saying, "Shall I go up to one of the cities of Judah?" Remember now, he's in Ziklag, which is southwest of Israel in the Philistine plain. And the Lord said to him, "Go up." So David said, "Where shall I go up?" And he said, "To Hebron." Now afterwards, it's probably the next day, John Gill says, after David was at Ziklag, David had killed an Amalekite who came up and had given David Saul's crown and bracelet, saying, "I killed Saul." And David wasn't happy about that. "You killed the Lord's anointed?" So it was probably right after that David said, "Well, what am I going to do now? Saul's dead. Should I try to take the kingdom, or at least the kingship of Judah, not the whole country, but at least of Judah?" He was going to start to take over the kingdom one step at a time. And so he inquired of the Lord. Now, how did he do that? Here's the options from the NIV Study Bible. He could have used the Urim and Thummim, that divine soothsaying device that was kept in the fold of the breastplate, which was attached to the ephod, which was worn over the robe of the high priest. Abiathar the priest, the high priest, was still with David at this time. Or he could have consulted a prophet, or he could have just prayed and received an audible answer. I suspect it was the Urim and Thummim. "Should I go up? White stone, yes. Black stone, no." That kind of thing. Nobody knows what the Urim and Thummim was. But at any rate, David inquires of the Lord. David said, "Where shall I go? Shall I go here? Shall I go here? White stone, yeah. Shall I go to Hebron? White stone, yes. Okay, we're going to Hebron." Now, notice how cautious David is. Samuel has already prophesied David to be king, of course, when Samuel went down to Jesse's house in Bethlehem. That famous story. But he still didn't want to do anything out of the will of God. Yes, he's going to be king, but when and how is up to God. Adam Clark says David did not know which tribes of Israel were ready to receive him as king. Remember, Saul had an heir, Ishbosheth, who was at Gibeah, the fourth son of Saul, who did not go up to the battle at Gilboa, and who was not killed because of that. Now, why did David go from Ziklag to Judah? Well, that was a logical choice. Most of David's friends were in Judah. And remember, David had done some preliminary politicking in 1 Samuel 30, verse 26. "Now when David came to Ziklag, he sent some of the spoil to the elders of Judah, to his friends, saying, 'Behold, a gift for you from the spoil of the enemies of the Lord.'" That's when he stole the Amalekites' plunder, which the Amalekites had stolen from him when he burnt Ziklag down, when David was up there pretending to be in the Philistine army fighting against Saul. And then David came back, found a city burnt down, chased the Amalekites south, not only took his spoil back, but also took a lot of the Amalekites' spoil, which they had taken from a bunch of other cities. And so then David took all that loot and spread it out amongst his friends in Judah. So he politicked in advance of this. Now, Hebron was a logical place to go for David. It's the chief metropolis of Judah. Jerusalem, of course, was in the hands of the Jebusites, the pagans. Gibeah was the head of the Israelite kingdom before, which is just about 3 miles straight north of Jerusalem. Hebron is about halfway down the Sea of Galilee, maybe 10 miles east of the coast, of the western coast, not the Sea of Galilee, the Dead Sea, about 10 miles west of the western coast of the Dead Sea, about halfway down from north to south. Let me read you some information about Hebron from Easton's Dictionary. Hebron's a famous place, it's still there. Hebron means a community, the word does, or alliance. It's about midway between Jerusalem and Bathsheba, from which it is distant about 20 miles on a straight line. Bathsheba is straight southwest, 20 miles. It still exists under the same name of Hebron, and it is one of the most ancient cities in the world, like Damascus, Hebron, still around today. Its earlier name was Kiriath Arba, but Hebron would appear to have been the original name of the city, and it was not till after Abraham stayed there that it received the name of Kiriath Arba, which means the city of Arba. Arba was not the founder, but the conqueror of the city, having led thither the tribe of the Anakim, the giants to which he belonged. It retained that name until it came to possession of Caleb, when the Israelites restored its original name, Hebron. So Caleb inherited Hebron as his lot in the promised land, the famous Caleb and Joshua, the two spies that spied out the land and said, let's take the land. It was the favorite home of Abraham. Here he pitched his tent under the oaks of Mamre, by which name it came afterwards to be known. And here Sarah died and was buried in the cave of Machpelah there at Hebron. And even today, it's a tourist place where all the graves are there. I'll give you $1 million bet that it's not the same place that Sarah was buried, but you know how those things are. But so they've got it restored there as Sarah's tomb and so forth. From Hebron, the patriarch Abraham departed for Egypt by way of Beersheba. It became a Levitical city, one of the six cities of refuge. When David became king of Judah, this was his royal residence, and he lived there for 7.5 years. We're going to talk about that in just a minute. It became the residence also of the rebellious Absalom, who probably expected to find his chief support in the tribe of Judah down there when Absalom rebelled against King David later on in 2 Samuel. In one part of the modern city is a great mosque, which is built over the grave of Machpelah. And then there's some interesting stuff in the 1800s. Some Prussian royalty went there and visited. It's amazing. That city has a long history. You look it up on Wikipedia and get some pictures of it. It's still there. So David decides to go to Hebron. We go now to 2 Samuel chapter 2, verses 2 through 7. So David went up there and his two wives also, Ahinoam the Jezreelitess, and Abigail the widow of Nabal the Carmelite. And David brought up his men who were with him, each with his household, and they lived in the cities of Hebron. Then the men of Judah came and there anointed David king over the house of Judah. And they told David, saying, it was the men of Jabesh-Gilead who buried Saul. David sent messengers to the men of Jabesh-Gilead and said to them, may you be blessed of the Lord, because you have shown this kindness to Saul your Lord and have buried him. Now may the Lord show loving kindness and truth to you, and I also will show this, the Home of Christian Study Bible says the same, I will show the same goodness to you because you have done this thing. Now therefore let your hands be strong and be valiant, for Saul your Lord is dead, and also the house of Judah has anointed me king over them, over the house of Judah. So David's men didn't actually settle in Hebron, but around the cities of Hebron, it says in verse 3. That's because there wasn't enough room in the city. It was a city of refuge for priests, John Gill says, so there's not enough room for David's men. Now verse 4 says, then the men of Judah came and anointed David king over the house of Judah. Now notice that was not over Israel, not all of Israel, just over the southern tribe of Judah. Neither the tribe of Judah or David wanted to force the issue, apparently. They weren't going to claim too much. David was willing to take the kingdom by degrees. Now, while David is at Hebron, the people there told him about how the men of Jabesh-Gilead had buried Saul. Now, we've already covered that story at the end of 1 Samuel. Saul lost the Battle of Gibeah to the Philistines. He and Jonathan and Ishvi and Malchishua, his three sons, were decapitated and their bodies nailed up on the walls of Bethshan. The men of Jabesh-Gilead were right across the Jordan River to the east of the Jordan River. They went over to Bethshan, took the bodies down, burnt the bodies. They had to because the bodies were decomposing. They took the bones of Saul and his three sons back to Jabesh-Gilead and buried them there as a sign of honor. And the reason they did that was because when Saul became king of Israel, his very first battle was to deliver the men of Jabesh-Gilead from Nahash, the Ammonite king, who had attacked the city. Now, David was told about this, probably because that was the first thing he asked when he got there. Has anybody heard any news about what happened to Saul? Well, when he heard it, he said, okay, you gave Saul Jabesh-Gilead. You gave Saul an honorable burial. That's exactly what I was asking about. I wanted to find out where Saul was so I could bury him, and you've done it. So David sends messengers to Jabesh-Gilead. Now, that's further to the north, right, maybe 7 or 8 miles to the east of the Jordan River, right south of Bethshan, which is right at near the Jordan River to the south, at the southern tip of the Sea of Galilee. So David sends messengers up there. This is far north of Judah. Adam Clark says, this was a generous and noble act, highly indicative of the grandeur of David's mind. Adam Clark goes on to say, David certainly wished to attach the men of Jabesh to his interest. He saw that they were generous and valiant and must be of great service to him whose part they espoused. And he was no doubt afraid that they would attach themselves to the house of Saul in consideration of the eminent services Saul had rendered them in rescuing them from Nahash, king of the Ammonites. So Basically, what Clark is saying here is David is a master politician. Oh, you honored Saul? Well, yeah, Saul and I had our disagreements, but you honored the king of Israel, so God bless you. I mean, you could think that David would be angry at the Ammonites for burying his mortal enemy, but David never took that attitude toward Saul. Saul's kingship was a tragedy, and David always looked at it that way, as something bad that happened to the house of Israel, unfortunately. So he was not Saul's personal enemy. David calls the men of Jabesh-Gilead valiant. Why? Well, the men of Jabesh-Gilead could expect the Philistines to be upset with them. They took down the bodies that they had so meticulously and carefully nailed to the wall at Bethshan, and they took down Saul and his three bodies. Philistines, three sons' bodies. The Philistines might have been upset about that and might attack the men of Jabesh-Gilead, but they took the risk anyway. Verse 7, I said David called them valiant. He actually encouraged them to be valiant. He said, now therefore let your hands be strong and valiant. Saul is dead, and the house of Judah has anointed me king over them. Now, he's mentioning that he's been anointed as a king. He doesn't mention king over Israel, it's the house of Judah. But perhaps by mentioning this here, David is giving a veiled suggestion that the Jabesh-Gileites also take David as king. In other words, hey guys, why don't you let me be your king instead of Ishbosheth in Gibeah, instead of the house of Saul? We go down to 2 Samuel 2, verses 8 through 9. But Abner, the son of Ner, commander of Saul's army, had taken Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, and brought him over to Mahanaim. He made him king over Gilead, over the Asherites, over Jezreel, over Ephraim, and over Benjamin, even over all Israel. Now, Abner is Saul's first cousin. He had long been one of Saul's chief military officers. As John Gill said, he was the commander-in-chief on several occasions. He was the big military guy. He was probably envious of David's power, John Gill says, because David had often out-generaled Abner in the field as Saul had been trying to chase down David when in that civil war there that ran David into the wilderness. It was Abner chasing him, but David outsmarted him every time. So Abner the son of Ner is Saul's uncle, 1 Samuel 14, 50, second part of the verse, and the name of the captain of his army was Abner the son of Ner, Saul's uncle. You could read that verse as saying it was Abner who was Saul's uncle, but no, I don't think so. It was Ner that was Saul's uncle, and Abner was his son, so Saul's the first cousin of Abner. Now, Ner takes Ishbosheth and sets him up as king over Israel, except for Judah. Ishbosheth seems to be the only son that Saul had left beside those of Saul's concubines. They don't count. The name means man of shame. Ish is man, Bosheth is shame, man of shame, as BibleStudyTools.com notes. He also had another name called Eshbaal, 2 Chronicles 8:33. Ner became the father of Kish, Kish became the father of Saul, and Saul became the father of Jonathan, Malchishua, Abinadab, who's also known as Ishvi, and Eshbaal. So he's got two names. Well, Eshbaal means man, and Baal means the famous Baal god. He's the man of Baal. Baal is the name of a shameful idol, John Gill says, and which was therefore sometimes called Bosheth, shame. So Ishbosheth is man of shame. What a name, Ishbosheth, man of shame. Bosheth being substituted for Baal when he was called man of Baal. Well, maybe his mother didn't give him that name. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown suggest that maybe Ishbosheth was called man of shame because of his imbecility. Well, whether it was because of his imbecility, I don't know how Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown know that. Or it was because he was a man of shame or a man of Baal, shame being a substitute way of saying Baal, since Baal is a shameful god. Either way, apparently he didn't get that name from his mother. People called him that later. So Ishbosheth is not exactly a great king of Saul. Now Abner sets up Ishbosheth, even though Abner knew it was the will of God for David to be king. Everybody knew of Samuel's anointing of David by now. Yet Abner persisted in trying to maintain Saul's dynasty. He persisted in trying to anoint a lame man and an imbecile. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown calls him an imbecile. We'll see. Abner takes Ishbosheth and sets him up as king at Mahanaim, not in Gibeah, but in Mahanaim. Now, where is that? If you look at the river and look at the map, you got the Jabbok River coming from the east, going west towards the Jordan River. And right when it almost hits there, it takes a sharp southwest turn and enters the Jordan River right above Adam. That's where the waters backed up during the times of Joshua. And right before that southwestern bend of the Jabbok River, you see Mahanaim, Peniel, and then you go about 4 or 5 miles due west into the Jordan Valley is Succoth. And that is Mahanaim, about 4 or 5 miles to the east of Succoth is Mahanaim, right there on the Jabbok River. Now, these areas are famous because this is where Jacob, in returning from Haran in Syria to go get his wife, his wives, Jacob and Leah, remember Laban was chasing him, came to meet him there. Before that happened, Jacob had a wrestling match with the angel of Jehovah, Jesus, got wounded in his hip. That famous incident took place right here in the area of Mahanaim. Peniel is right basically on top of the spot. Mahanaim is actually marked with a question mark on my map, BibleAtlas.org map. Mizpah is about 4 or 5 miles to the south of the famous Mizpah benediction took place between Jacob and Laban. Laban, may the Lord be with you between me and thee until we meet again. The one that's said all the time in churches today, ritualistically. So all of this area is well known and it's east of the Jordan River. Why there? Well, it's close to just south of Jabesh Gilead on the eastern side of the Jordan. So putting the king there would keep Jabesh Gilead from going over to David. David's trying to get Jabesh Gilead. David had just sent messengers there praising the city for burying Saul, as we saw in verse 5. That's one reason. Another reason is Mahanaim is a far away place, away from Hebron, where David was, also away from the Philistines, who were still the Israelites' enemies. They're out to the west and the southwest. So Mahanaim seems to be a safer place, a good place to get Ishbosheth's kingdom established in the midst of the disaster at Gilboa. Mahanaim was probably well fortified, another good reason to put Ishbosheth there. BibleAtlas.org says, quote, the strength of the place doubtless attracted Abner. Good reasons why Abner set up Ishbosheth at Mahanaim. He makes him king over several places, including Gilead. That's not just one. There's a little town over there called Gilead, but it refers to the whole region east of the Jordan River. That would be Gad, Reuben, and half Manasseh, the 2.5 eastern tribes in the Transjordan area. And then is mentioned that Ishbosheth is king of the Asherites. That's the people from the tribe of Asher, which is along the coast between Acre and Tyre, Mediterranean coast in the north. Now, I say it's the tribe of Asher. John Gill says that it's not generally agreed that Asherites are people from the tribe of Asher, but I'll just assume it is. And then verse 9 mentions that Ishbosheth is king over the people in Jezreel. That's in the northern part of Israel in the Jezreel Valley, running from Carmel in the northwest down to Beth Shan in the southeast, running from northwest to southeast as you go from the Mediterranean Sea to the Jordan River. So Ishbosheth was king over the tribes of Zebulun, Issachar, and Naphtali. Naphtali is right to the east of Asher, right to the west of the Sea of Galilee and Lake Hula. And Zebulun is in the northwestern part of the Jezreel Valley. Issachar is in the southeastern part of the Jezreel Valley. So all of that is just saying the northern part of Israel is under Ishbosheth's reign. And finally, in verse 9, it just says that Ishbosheth was king over all Israel, except Judah, of course. Abner was carefully getting the allegiance of the tribes one by one. And David, meanwhile, is standing pat, remaining still. He was waiting for God's timing to get the kingdom. He didn't want to fight Ishbosheth. David had sworn to Saul at En Gedi that he would not kill Saul's descendants. That's when David had a chance to kill Saul when he was relieving himself in a cave. David cut off a piece of his cloak, showed it to Saul later. When Saul came out of the cave, and David came out of the cave too and said, look here, I got your cloak. I could have killed you. And at that time, Saul says, oh, I'm so sorry, David. I'm so sorry. 1 Samuel 24:21. Saul says, so now swear to me, David, by the Lord, that you will not cut off my descendants after me and that you will not destroy my name from my father's household. And we assume that David did swear that. He had swore not to kill Saul's descendants. That means Ishbosheth was a charmed man. David's not going to kill him. We go down to 2 Samuel 2, verses 10 through 12. Ishbosheth, Saul's son, was 40 years old when he became king over Israel, and he was king for 2 years. The house of Judah, however, followed David. The time that David was king in Hebron over the house of Judah was 7 years and 6 months. Now Abner, the son of Ner, went out from Mahanaim to Gibeon with the servants of Ishbosheth, the son of Saul. Now the first problem we have here is that Ishbosheth ruled for 2 years, but David ruled for 7.5 years, so there's 5.5 years missing after Ishbosheth's 2-year rule. What happened to it? Here's several options to answer that. First option is there was a vacancy in the reign of Israel for the 5.5 years. Option number 2, Ishbosheth had reigned for 2 years when war broke out between Abner and David. So it would read this way, he was king for 2 years until Abner and David started fighting. Option number 3, Ishbosheth reigned 2 years before any tribe but Judah attached itself to David. In other words, it would read, he reigned for 2 years over the whole of Israel until Israel started peeling off and attaching itself to David. Fourth option, when Ishbosheth had reigned over Israel for 2 years, he became 40 years old. Fifth option, Ishbosheth reigned for 2 years, at which time Abner crossed from Mahanaim to Gibeon to fight the Battle of Gibeon. Well, it's very obvious that time reference of 2 years is absolutely meaningless to us because nobody knows exactly what it means. But at any rate, we find out in verse 11 that David ruled in Hebron over Judah for 7.5 years. Well, if you take that 7.5 years in Hebron plus 33 years over the entire kingdom, he ruled for 40.5 years, which is usually rounded to 40 years. We see this in 2 Samuel 5, verse 4. David was 30 years old when he became king, and he reigned 40 years. Now, as far as the timing of all this, again, the dates are always fuzzy, but the BibleHub.com timeline has David being made king over Judah in 1010 B.C., which is right where we are now. And then 37 years later, he became king over all of Israel at 1003. Now, in verse 12, Abner, the military leader of Israel, went out from Mahanaim, where he had installed Ishbosheth, and he goes to Gibeon. Now, we need to see where Gibeon is. If you look at where Jerusalem is, and you look at the road going straight north from Jerusalem, you hit Gibeah first, then you hit Ramah, then you hit Mizpah, then you hit Bethel at about 4 or 5 mile intervals. Well, as you go up that road and you get right about Ramah, Samuel's hometown and where Samuel died, and you go east from there about 3 miles, you hit Gibeon. Now, Gibeon is not the same town as Gibeah. Gibeah is about 3 miles, 4 miles north of Jerusalem. Gibeon on that road, but Gibeon is to the east, further to the east. It's about maybe 4 miles to the northeast of Gibeah. So Gibeah is the national seat of government for Israel when Saul was king. It was Saul's hometown. Now Gibeon is an entirely different town. It sounds the same. Now here's what Easton says about Gibeon. Gibeon means hill city. It's one of the royal cities. Its inhabitants were Hivites. It was in the tribe of Benjamin. The tabernacle was set up there after the destruction of Nob, and here it remained many years until the temple was built by Solomon. So that's another reason why Gibeon's famous. Now remember, the tabernacle was at Shiloh, and then it went down to Nob, which is right north of the Mount of Olives, and then it went about 10 miles to the northeast to Gibeon. Now, the ark, which was separated from the temple at the Battle of Shiloh, remember when Eli's sons got beat by the Philistines, and as it made its way from Philistia back into the people of Israel because it was causing plagues among the Philistines, it ended up in Israel at Kiriath-Yearim, and that is about 7 or 8 miles to the southwest of Gibeon. So the ark is at Gibeon, the tabernacle is at Gibeon, the ark is at Kiriath-Yearim, about 7 or 8 miles apart. It's interesting, they ended up being fairly close to one another. All right, so Gibeon's famous for holding the ark until David brings it back into Jerusalem when he becomes king later on. Gibeon is also famous because they were the ones that induced Joshua to enter into a league with them because they didn't want to get wiped out by Joshua and the Israelites. And they said, hey, we came from a long way off. We know you're supposed to wipe out the people of Canaan. We're not from Canaan. We're a long way from Canaan. So don't kill us. And so Joshua was fooled into making a covenant with the Gibeonites. That was a famous incident. Gibeon is also famous because in the book of Joshua, Joshua had a big battle there right before he went on his southern campaign. The Gibeonites had asked Joshua to come to their help. He comes up. He routs all of the Canaanite kings who had allied themselves against Gibeon because Gibeon was allied with Joshua. And then we end up in the Battle of Beth Horon, which is right to the northwest of Gibeon. And we read all about that when we were in Joshua. So Gibeon is a well-known place, and that's where we are now. And we go now to 2 Samuel chapter 2, verses 13 through 16. And Joab, the son of Zeruiah, and the servants of David went out and met them by the pool of Gibeon. Met who? Met Abner and the servants of Ishbosheth. So it's the Judahites versus the Benjaminites. And they sat down, one on one side of the pool, and the other on the other side of the pool. Then Abner said to Joab, now remember, Joab is David's chief military officer. David's not there. He's back in Hebron. But Joab is there, and Abner's there. So this is a meeting between the generals, not the kings. Ishbosheth is back in Mahanaim, and David is in Hebron. Verse 14, then Abner said to Joab, now let the young men arise and hold a contest before us. And Joab said, let them arise. So they arose and went over by count, 12 from Benjamin and Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, and 12 of the servants of David. Each one of them seized his opponent by the head and thrust his sword in his opponent's side, so they fell down together. Therefore that place was called Helkath Hazurim, which is in Gibeon. Now verse 13, Joab is sitting down with Abner by a pool to negotiate. Joab had probably been given orders by David not to attack, but only to act on the defensive to try as much as possible to avoid the shedding of blood. Joab is called the son of Zeruiah. Zeruiah was David's sister, and Zeruiah had three sons, as we see from 2 Samuel 2:18, which is coming up in a couple of verses. So the three sons of Zeruiah are Abishai, Joab, and Asahel. Abishai had gone with David to at Halakah when Saul was sleeping in the camp with a jug of water and a spear by his head, and Abishai and David helped steal those two things, proving that David did not want to kill Saul. So that's why Abishai is famous. Joab, as I've just said, is the head of David's military. We're going to see Asahel. He was the brother of Abishai and Joab. He was the son of Zeruiah, David's sister, and he's going to get himself killed here in just a minute. So these three guys are relatively famous. They're all of David's nephews because they are the sons of David's sister, Zeruiah. Now, Joab and company sat down on one side of the pool, and Abner and company sat down on the other side of the pool. No doubt they were watching each other very carefully, as John Gill says. Not a lot of trust between them. Verse 14, Abner proposes a gladiatorial contest. Why did Abner want to risk everything in a hand-to-hand combat? He had all the other tribes. David had just one. Why would he want to risk the whole kingdom on a roll of the dice, a hand-to-hand fight? Well, here's some reasons. It's true, Abner had all of Israel, all the other tribes, but Judah was a numerous tribe. It was a powerful tribe, and it was very militarily successful because David was ahead of it. Not only that, John Gill speculates that many of the people of the other tribes had joined with Judah. The people knew that God, through Samuel, had prophesied David would be king, and I'm sure that people were defecting from Israel to Judah. And so Abner realizes he's in a bad way here, and so he says, well, let's just duke it out. Maybe I'll be lucky and win one. Now, to me, that's the reason, but other people have speculated on why he did this, and one option is amazing to me. It was an exhibition for diversion. Well, we're bored here. We don't have any baseball. We don't have any basketball. We don't have any football. So let's just have a gladiatorial combat and watch our young men kill each other. Many commentators actually say that. I think that's absolutely ridiculous. The real reason was, is as I said, Abner was hoping he would win when he was in trouble. And remember, Abner's fighting against the prophecy of Samuel that David's going to rule the kingdom. And so Abner figures, well, maybe I can win. And Joab might have thought, well, this is a substitute for a bigger, bloodier battle, as the NIV Study Bible said. You know, Goliath challenged David to do the same thing. That was a challenge. Whoever wins, wins the whole battle. But of course, David won and Goliath and the Philistines ran. They didn't submit themselves to David like Goliath said he would do if he got beat. And I think that that is the problem with these one-on-one substitute contests. Just because you win, that doesn't guarantee that the opposing side is going to abide by the rules of the game. So these 24 young men hack each other to death and kill each other. Each one of them, in verse 16, seized his opponent by the head, probably by the beard that was on the head. As Adam Clark says, Clark mentions that Alexander the Great had his men shave their beards because he said that in battle there is no better hold than a beard. Now, if you think about this hand-to-hand combat here, it makes it sound like there were 12 individual battles, one person fighting another person, because it says each one of them seized his opponent by the head and thrust his sword in his opponent's side. That's what it sounds like, but I don't believe that's what happened. I believe that all 12 of them were fighting the other 12. So if you manage to hack somebody on the other side, you could yourself get hacked by another person on the other side. In other words, it's a group battle, not 12 single battles. And they managed to kill each other. I imagine some of them were wounded as they lay there dying. It's a perfectly hideous sight. Therefore, that place was called Helkath Hazarim. Helkath means field. Hazarim means daggers. The NIV note says the phrase means the field of daggers, or perhaps it means the field of hostilities. Either way, it became famous there at Gibeon for what happened. We go to verse 17. That day the battle was very severe, and Abner and the men of Israel were beaten before the servants of David. Well, we're assuming here that David's troops and Joab's troops, in other words, and Abner's troops started fighting each other after their champions killed each other, their 24 champions that killed each other. They decided, well, we're just going to have to fight this out in a normal way like armies normally do. The small substitute battle ended in a stalemate, and I'm sure the spectators watching this battle had their passions aroused and said, oh, let's go get them, you know, and so they started fighting each other. We go to 2 Samuel chapter 2, verses 18 through 21. Now the three sons of Zeruiah were there, Joab and Abishai and Asahel, the three I've just mentioned. And Asahel was as swift-footed as one of the gazelles which is in the field. Asahel pursued Abner and did not turn to the right or to the left from following Abner. Then Abner looked behind him and said, is that you, Asahel? And he, Asahel, answered, it is I. So Abner said to him, turn to your right or to your left and take hold of one of the young men for yourself and take for yourself his spoil. But Asahel was not willing to turn aside from following him. Now, why did Asahel pursue Abner? Here's a couple of options. Asahel was ambitious of glory. He wanted the glory of slaying the chief general in opposition to the armies of David. That's one reason. Another reason he trusted in his swiftness. Now, doesn't this sound like a young warrior, young man, young and numb? I want glory, and I'm fast, and I can beat anybody. He ended up getting himself killed. It says in verse 19 that Asahel did not turn to the right or to the left from following Abner. Why might he do that? Remember now, Abner's army is in retreat. The servants of David had just beaten the army, and so the army is heading out of Gibeon, heading out of town, running, and it could very well have happened that Asahel says, oh, I see a soldier over there. I think I'll go kill him and steal his armor. But he didn't do that. Single-mindedly, he went after Abner. He might have seen another soldier and thought, well, I'll take him as prisoner, or I'll take his armor. We don't know, but he didn't. Now, in verse 20, Saul says, is that you, Asahel? Abner seems to know Asahel personally. He's probably well acquainted with his family, as John Gill says, and so he's just confirming what he thought, probably. Is that you, Asahel? And he answered, it is I. Now, when Abner knows for sure that it's Asahel, in verse 21, Abner says, hey, Asahel, go to the right, go to the left, take hold one of the young men, find a soldier, take for yourself his spoil. Now, Abner here does not ask Asahel to turn back. That would have been disgraceful for Asahel. To turn back would look like an act of cowardice. So he doesn't ask Asahel to do something he knows Asahel's not going to do. Rather, he asks Asahel to look as if he were pursuing someone else, another soldier. So that would not be an act of cowardice. It would be a normal thing for a soldier to do. That's John Gill's opinion. I think that makes a lot of sense. Verse 21, Abner says to Asahel, take hold of one of the young men for yourself. Young men. The implication is that Asahel can take a young soldier like Asahel, but he wasn't going to be able to take a veteran like Abner, which, as we'll see, is exactly what happened. Abner seems to be trying to save the young man's life. He's trying to protect, apparently, both Asahel's honor and his life. Go chase another soldier. You won't die by my hand, and you'll get some spoil, and everybody will think that you're a brave soldier. Now, Abner, from his point of view, is probably trying to make sure that there was no love lost between David's family and himself. There would not be any desire for blood vengeance between David's family and himself. We are going to find out that's exactly what happened, because Abner knows that Asahel is Joab's brother and David's nephew, and Abner probably knows that his kingdom is shot. He's got an imbecile on the throne. He's just lost another battle. They've lost the battle at Gilboa to the Philistines. Now they've lost the battle of Gibeon to David and the Judahites. He probably sees the handwriting on the wall. He doesn't want to be killing David's nephew. Verse 21, but Asahel was not willing to turn aside to capture another soldier. Asahel seems to be fired by a great ambition, John Gill says. Gill speculates also that Asahel may have become more determined after Abner had given Asahel his way out. Oh, you're trying to get rid of me, huh, Abner? Well, you're not going to do it with all your fancy talk. I'm going to come get you because I'm young and dumb. Now, this idea that Abner gave to Asahel to turn aside and get spoil, he says, take for yourself this young man's that you've killed, his spoil, that would be his armor. That was a big deal for soldiers back then. greatly coveted armor was as a trophy. We go down to 2 Samuel 2, verses 22 through 23. Abner repeated again to Asahel, "Turn aside from following me. Why should I strike you to the ground? How then could I lift up my face to your brother Joab?" Now, right there, this seems to be that Abner realizes that he's going to have to deal with Joab in the future because his cause is lost in northern Israel. And he's going to have to deal with Joab, and Joab would be quite upset if he knew that Abner had killed his brother Asahel. So Abner's still trying to get out of this. Verse 23, "However, he," that's Asahel, "refused to turn aside. Therefore, Abner struck him in the belly with the butt end of the spear, so that the spear came out at his back, and he fell there and died on the spot. And it came about that all who came to the place where Asahel had fallen and died stood still." Now, the butt end of the spear, that's kind of interesting. I suspect it was a surprise move. He had the spear turned backwards, and he's talking to Asahel. "Hey, Asahel, look, I can't face your brother Joab. Quit following me. Don't do this." And then when Asahel obviously was not going to turn away, he just thrust the butt end of the spear forward, which would have completely taken Asahel by surprise because the spear's sharp end was turned the other way. And then all who came to the place where Asahel had fallen and died, they stood still. Who is that all there? David's men who were in pursuit of the Israelites, of course. Why did they stand still? Well, option number one, they had no more power to pursue. They were so troubled and grieved at Asahel's death. Or it could have been, which the thing that stopped them was the gruesome manner of Asahel's death. And NIV Study Bible says no one is killed by the butt of a spear. That's pretty gross. But I did read one commentator that said that Eastern warriors often did this, so I don't know who's right there. Option number three, David's soldiers could have been disheartened that a man as fast as Asahel could be killed. Asahel was noted for being fast. Option number four, David's soldiers could have been stunned that their commander's own brother had not survived. Or it could be a combination of all that. At any rate, they stopped and stared at the gruesome sight. We go now to 2 Samuel chapter 2, verses 24 through 26. But Joab and Abishai pursued Abner, the two remaining brothers. And when the sun was going down, they came to the hill of Ammah, which is in front of Giah, by the way of the wilderness of Gibeon. The sons of Benjamin gathered together behind Abner and became one band, and they stood on the top of a certain hill. Then Abner called to Joab and said, "Shall the sword devour forever? Do you not know that it will be bitter in the end? How long will you refrain from telling the people to turn back from following their brothers?" Their brothers. A little civil war here between brothers, the northern Israelites and the southern Israelites. Now, these places where this hill of Ammah means a cubit. Easton says nothing about it. It's just near Gibeon. It's in front of Giah. It's a place near Gibeon, nowhere else mentioned in the Bible. It doesn't matter. It's just somewhere around Gibeon. And in verse 25, Abner and his soldiers came to the top of a certain hill, some hill near Gibeon. Apparently, the soldiers had rallied. After being routed, they gathered themselves together for one last stand. Verse 25 says the sons of Benjamin did this, rallied at the top of a certain hill. That could refer to the soldiers of Abner that were fighting in this battle of Gibeon. It could be that some other reinforcements came from Benjamin to help the soldiers of Abner out. Because after all, Gibeon is in the tribe of Benjamin. That's a speculation. At any rate, even though Abner was beaten and retreating, it was an orderly retreat, apparently. He was now regrouped on top of a hill, and he had a tactical advantage because he was on top of the hill, which means if you have to attack going uphill, that's real hard on a soldier. But Abner decides he doesn't want to fight anymore, and I'm sure because he's scared he was going to get beat. And so he points out that this thing's getting bloody. It's a civil war. You're fighting your brothers. It's going to be bitter in the end because we're going to fight to the death. Civil wars are always the bitterest and always the nastiest. And so Abner's doing his dead-level best to negotiate himself out of the situation. But you know, Abner might should have thought of this before he started the battle. Remember, he started this whole thing by moving from Mahanaim to Gibeon. He started it. But as John Gill points out, Abner's changed his tune now that the battle has gone against him. David was not the aggressor in this battle. He was playing defense the whole time. Abner was the one who brought his forces down to Judah, and we can speculate that David was doing everything he could to avoid bloodshed. We go now to 2 Samuel chapter 2, verses 27 through 28. Joab said, "As God lives, if you had not spoken, surely then the people would have gone away in the morning, each from following his brother." So Joab blew the trumpet, and all the people halted and pursued Israel no longer, nor did they continue to fight any more. There's that common oath that Israelites took, "As God lives, as the Lord lives." That shows that it was a special, serious word that he's speaking. Now, he says something a little bit strange here. Joab says, "Abner, if you hadn't spoken, then this whole thing would be over." Well, what does that mean? Well, John Gill, Adam Clark, and most of the Jewish rabbis, they say that this is referring to Abner's challenge to fight Judah when he went down to Gideon, to Gibeon at the pool of Gibeon. And Abner says to Joab in verse 14 of this chapter, 2 Samuel 2, Abner said to Joab, "Now let the young men arise and hold a contest before us." In other words, if you just hadn't started this fight, there wouldn't be any bloodshed. Everybody would go away, each from following his brother. In other words, each from chasing his brother down to kill him, it'd be over with. It wouldn't happen. If you'd just kept your mouth shut, Abner. There's another option. It could be the words that Abner had just spoken. Those words where he said, "This is going to be bitter. Shall the sword devour forever?" When are you going to tell your people to start chasing your brothers? Well, that doesn't make any sense to me, because why would that stop Joab from following? Joab says, "If you had not spoken these words, shall the sword devour forever, then the people would have gone away in peace. But since you did speak these words, there's going to be a war." Well, that doesn't make any sense to me. So basically what Joab is saying, look, you started this fight. Joab is not intending to fight any further. In fact, he probably agrees with Abner that there's no point in this carrying the civil war out any further and creating more bloodshed. We've already beat him. Let's don't look for total victory here. But Joab is going to give Abner a parting shot. Hey, if you hadn't spoken, there wouldn't be any of this bloodshed. I think that's what's going on here. Verse 28, so Joab blew the trumpet, and all the people halted and pursued Israel no longer, nor did they continue to fight anymore. They didn't fight anymore that day. The Battle of Gibeon was over, but that doesn't mean there wasn't a long war afterwards. 2 Samuel 3, verse 1, our next chapter. Now there was a long war between the house of Saul and the house of David. And David grew steadily stronger, but the house of Saul grew weaker continually. So it took David a while to militarily conquer Israel. This was the first battle. It was won by David, but it wasn't enough. He had to win some more. We go now to 2 Samuel 2, verse 29. Abner and his men then went through the Arabah all that night, so they crossed the Jordan, walked all morning, and came to Mahanaim. Arabah, of course, is the plain of the Jordan. It's the rift that runs from the southern end of the Dead Sea to the northern tip of the Dead Sea, from the southern tip of the Dead Sea all the way to the Gulf of Aqaba. But right, it's basically the Jordan Valley. So Abner, they flee east, get to the Jordan Valley, near Succoth, probably, near the fords there, and then they crossed over to Mahanaim, which is on the other side of the Jordan River. Now the question arises, why did Abner go on a night march the day following a battle? Well, he may have feared Joab might change his mind and come after him, and I suspect that's what it is. He might have thought Joab might be a little upset that Abner had killed his brother Asahel, and so that maybe Joab's looking for a little bit of vengeance. Some people speculate that Joab hadn't actually discovered Asahel's death yet, and so would not have vengeance in his mind, but I don't believe that. Somebody would have told Joab of such a momentous event as the death of his brother. So the men of Israel, of Abner, head back to Mahanaim with their tails between their legs. It says they went through the Arabah all that night. Again, we talked about why they might go on a night march. Actually, there's a translation problem here. The KJV actually translates that as through all Bithron. The NIV note says that the phrase there, all that night, might mean all that morning. Or it might mean through all that ravine. The meaning of the Hebrew for this word is uncertain. Then Joab returned from following Abner. When he had gathered all the people together, 19 of David's servants besides Asahel were missing. But the servants of David had struck down many of Benjamin and Abner's men, so that 360 men died. And they took up Asahel and buried him in his father's tomb, which was in Bethlehem. Then Joab and his men went all night until the day dawned at Hebron. Now in verse 30, when Joab returned from following Abner, John Gill says this fits in with David's idea of shedding as little blood as possible. He decided to quit chasing Abner. Joab did. Now, David lost 20 people, 19 servants plus Asahel. Abner, on Israel's side, lost 360 men. Small losses. It's interesting that such big stakes were resting here on the battles of such small forces. Whole kingdoms at stake. Asahel is buried in verse 32 at Bethlehem. That's his hometown. Remember, he's David's nephew, and David was from Bethlehem. Zeruiah, David's sister, was also grown up there in the house of Jesse in Bethlehem. So it was natural that he would be buried there. And then Joab, probably after the funeral, and his men went all night until the day dawned at Hebron. Now, that could be all night after Asahel's funeral, or it could be that Joab didn't go to the funeral. He left the night after the battle at Gibeon and went straight to Hebron. It's not really sure. But at either rate, why a night march at this time? Well, some people have speculated that Joab wanted to be sure David was not worried about the outcome of his confrontation with Abner. This was a big battle, and he wanted to tell David the good news. And, of course, Joab would get credit for the victory. So, ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished 2 Samuel chapter 2. We're ready to go now into the next chapter, chapter 3. We'll do the first half, verses 1 through 25, in our next audio. Abner joins David. Can't beat him, join him. Hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.